I've had a real interest in what am I going to leave behind. This partially is born out of the fact that we were left with bags and boxes and all sorts of photographs and documents and the like when our parents passed away. And I wanted to leave something a little bit more comprehensible than what we received. And I've been trying to figure out, well, how do you do this? How do you do this? And rather than dwell on that, I'd like to talk about my mother, Dorothy Katz Newman, who passed away in June at the age of 100. And she was an extraordinary lady. I particularly want to talk about her life cooking, because that seems to be sort of the dominant theme that ran through much of her life. And so I've been preparing, with Dawn's help back there, who's works for Legacy Preservation Services, and I've prepared a book, and I'll pass it around later, and it talks about her life through her cooking, which she did all her life from the age of 11. She grew up in a very, very poor family in the western, rural western part of Michigan. Her father had positive qualities, but caring for his family was not one of them. And so her mother, who was an immigrant and did not read or write English or drive, had the responsibility of not only raising the family, but also providing sustenance. And she did this, at least during the earlier years, by having a boarding house where, in, as I said, in rural western Michigan, not too far from a lake, you could walk there, where people who had a little bit more money than my mother's family would come out from Chicago to escape the heat of the summer, and they would board there. And starting at age 11, my mother helped her mother with the cooking. So when she died and we were cleaning out her house, I found a trove of her recipes written in many cases in her own hand and in other cases copied out of cookbooks and whatever. And you can see the stains because these were actually used. And you can see in many cases her comments that she added, good, whatever. She also hosted. She was the one that would host for her siblings the family meals. And one of the things we would have is a Seder, which involves a lot of, it is built around, it's both a commemoration, but it's also a dinner, a ceremonial dinner. And each year afterwards, she would write notes on what she served and the quantities and how appropriate those quantities were for the number of people who were there. And every year there would be way too much food for twice as many people, and she would make notes to that effect that she should have less. And every year the same notes were repeated because she would make the same amount or more the subsequent year. Why she made notes, I have no idea, because she paid absolutely no attention to them. I also have in here, which as you look at this, I trust you will find this interesting. After my parents were married and they had me, they started Newman's Restaurant in Miami, Florida. And again, I found some materials. This is the business card, and I've reproduced in this book that we're producing menus from Newman's Restaurant, where the special, I can't remember the special sirloin dinner was either 35 cents or 50 cents. So this was some time ago. And unfortunately, my mother broke her ankle and was in a cast and on crutches. And then my father was injured in a hit and run accident. And he was laid up for a number of months in a one-third or one-half body cast. And they lost the restaurant and went bankrupt. And they came north to work in the war plants, which is how I ended up in Michigan. She also well into her 70s and even into her 80s, was a volunteer cook at the Jewish Community Center. And there's some newspaper articles about her cooking in here, as well as, in one case, a condolence note that we received where somebody was talking about how active she was. And she was always bustling around, taking care of her seniors who were, for the most part, younger than she was. So that's the story of Dorothy Katz Newman and her life in cooking. This book, when it's finished, with Dawn's help and Jesse's, because a lot of the photographs and the documents here had to be digitized, will be published in a book form, as well as being on the available in a digital format, so that her, not only her grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but hopefully her great-great-great-grandchildren will have some idea of what a wonderful, giving human being she was.
Hat? Oh, the hat's part of my persona. And it even relates to the story to a certain extent. Again, I'm Ken Stockton. I'm 66 years old. And about 10 years ago, I was rooting around in the base of my house, looking through some of the life's collectibles, some meaningful and some not so meaningful. And amazingly enough, I found the baseball glove I used beginning at age 11 when I played Little League Baseball in Trenton, New Jersey. And back in the day, back in the 50s and 60s, baseball was the sport that a lot of little boys played. And making the Little League team was perceived as the first step toward being a Major League Baseball player. So, and this glove was my absolute prized possession. In fact, I can remember the day I went to the sporting goods store, Snyder's Sporting Goods Store, Perry Street, Trent, New Jersey. My dad took me there. And you know, when your dad took you to a sporting goods shop to buy you the number one tool of the trade toward being a Major League Baseball player, it was a big deal. I can remember the smell of the store. I can remember what it looked like. It smelled like leather. There were a lot of gloves. And I think my father plunked down a lot of money for 1959 for this glove. I think it cost like 10 bucks, which was a lot of money because I came from sort of a lower middle class, working class. And so that was a lot of money. So I found this glove. And an interesting element of finding the glove was, well, it was a prized possession back when I was 11. But when I found it in 2004, it also was part of my healing process from the biggest loss of my life that also happened in Trenton, New Jersey when I was 11 years old. Because, and here's the context, my coach was a very good coach, but he also was a pedophile. And very soon after I made the team, he formed a bond with me and began to abuse me, and he abused me for 3 years. And by my adult recollection, he raped me about 400 times during that 3-year period. I'll come back to the glove and why it helped my healing. But so in 2004, I finally tried to recover from all the consequences of being an abuse victim, which were extreme. I mean, self-doubt, intimacy issues, self-blame, anger. I was pissed. I mean, I was anger, and it was displaced anger. I was really mad at the coach, Fred, and I was mad at what happened to myself when I was 11 years old playing Little League Baseball in Trenton, New Jersey. So 40 years later, I resolved to find Fred and hold him accountable. And through the miracle of the web, I found him. I found out that he was still alive living in Trenton, New Jersey. He was now like 66 years old. He's 13 years older than me, by the way. He was 24 when he abused me when I was age 11. Found out that he was married. I found out that he had an adult son. And I also found out that he had never been arrested for anything, let alone abusing little boys. And he was definitely a serial pedophile because after he stopped abusing me, it was clear that he formed a relationship with another younger boy. So he's definitely a serial pedophile. So armed with this information, I got a lawyer in town who was willing to help me confront Fred, even though the statute of limitations had long since expired. And miracle of miracles, they agreed, Fred and now he had an attorney, agreed to a mediation to try and come up with some resolution. So 40 years later, I flew to New Jersey with my attorney. I met face to face with the monster who had done such terrible things to me when I was a little boy. It completely changed. It was an amazing healing process because I had flushed out this monster. I had held him accountable, and I no longer held myself accountable. It completely changed the power dynamics. I went from being a victim to being a victor. Now back to the glove. So during this whole period, when I was deciding, should I go after this guy? What should I do? During that period, that's when I found the glove. And, you know, it's weather-worn, you know, Don Hoke autograph model, Wilson. And I picked it up in the basement, and I put it on my hand. And the glove was way too small. And it was amazing because in that moment, I had an intellectual realization, an emotional realization, a physical realization very deeply that when I was 11 years old playing Little League baseball in Trenton, New Jersey, and being abused by this serial pedophile, I was not responsible. I was a little boy. I was incapable of defending myself. And so this meeting that I had with this monster and finding the baseball glove, my most prized possession when I was 11 years old, and putting on my hand were crucial elements of my healing as an adult victim.
I'm a first generation American. My father immigrated here from Germany when he was 19 years old in 1922. And he was a butcher by trade, and he was, I don't know, probably not enough people in this room would remember Steve Brothers. Good. But he was a partner with the Steve Brothers back in the 30s, and they said, well, why don't you go to Dexter? There's a store out there. And so he did, and he ran that, and he went out there with my mother, and they bought a house, and a couple years later, he decided to dissolve the partnership, and he'd take the Dexter store, and they'd stay in Ann Arbor. So I've had a fascination with Ann Arbor for many, many years, even though I haven't lived. I do live here now. I've lived here for the last 50 years. But came in a lot for piano lessons and a lot of other things like that. But so after I went to college, my dad kept, I worked for my dad when I was in high school. And all through college, or all through high school, he used to say, now you got to get a job where you can use your mind and not your back. So I finished college and I come back and he said, now you're going to get a job where you use your mind. Well, in those days, they had blind ads. There's no such thing today. They're illegal now. And there was an ad in the paper that didn't say who it was, but it sounded like it could have been a financial institution. So I applied for the ad, and they asked me in for an interview. And when my dad heard about who it was, oh, yeah, I know him. I know the president, Rudy Reichert. He says, he's not a bad guy. I think that'd be a good place to work. So I started in 1960 working for the Ann Arbor Bank as a teller. And I was there a year to the day, then I got drafted. And I was gone for 2 years, and I came back at 63, and stayed with them for over 30 years, and retired in 1996. But I just want to talk a little bit about the changes. When I first started at the bank, there were only three banks in three financial institutions in Ann Arbor. There was the National Bank and Trust, there was Ann Arbor Bank, and Ann Arbor Federal Savings and Loan. Now we have a multitude of financial institutions. And the banks basically had checking accounts and savings accounts and weren't real anxious to make mortgages, and the savings and the loan had savings accounts and made mortgages, but they didn't have checking accounts. So if somebody walked into Ann Arbor Federal and wanted a checking account, they would send them to us, and if somebody walked into me in a branch and wanted a mortgage, I'd send them to Ann Arbor Federal. And that's kind of the way it worked until in the 80s when it's changed all that, and the savings and loans have all got banking powers and all that. But our biggest account customer was probably the University of Michigan. And they came to us every fall and said, we need X number of people for registration. And it was in the old Waterman Gym. And I thought, gee, that sounds like fun. I think I'll try that. So I volunteered and went up there. And the student had to come in with the exact amount of whatever the tuition was. We did not give them change. I don't know how they figured that out, but that's the way it went. And you'd think you'd wait on a student and you'd look up and think maybe you get a break. No, the line's still there, and that went on. Each person, there might have been at least 10 of us working there, waited on like 600 or 700 kids in a day. And we didn't, and the bank did not get paid for that. That was part of the fact that we had the university's deposit. And National Bank and Trust had of it, and we did. They banked in two banks in town in those days. I worked what they called a 40-hour variable work week. That meant you might work 38 hours, but you get paid for 40. You might work 41 hours or 42 hours, you still got paid for 40. There was no overtime. That's the way it worked. And so we started building branches. They had just built a new branch when I started. They were on State Street, where Outfitters is now, I think, in the arcade there at the end of the arcade. And they moved over to East Liberty, 505 East Liberty, built a nice branch with a big parking lot. I've got pictures of it here afterwards. And now, last week I was up at the new Knight's restaurant, and I was sitting by the window, I looked across the street, and it's been cut up, the building has been cut up into about 5 or 6 different small ice cream shops or whatever they have, different types of shops like that, big changes. We were the first bank in town to have an ATM. That was about 1974. There were 4 or 5 other banks in the country that had them, and we were the 4th or 5th one that had them. And then when we first installed it, we had the manager. It was his or her responsibility to keep it supplied with money. So if it ran out of money at 10 o'clock at night, the manager got a call. You're out of money. Well, that was okay for a while. I had this gentleman, I was branch administrator at that time, and I had this manager that was a little older, and he came to me and he said, I'll tell you what. He says, either that ATM goes or I'm going, and I'm not going to service it anymore. So we got a crew out to service the ATMs, and that was a big deal. And of course, the banks loved the students because students brought free money. And that's why they enjoyed having the checking accounts. And the kids, especially the foreign students, they would come. They had big payrolls when they came, and it was just a good fun time. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
My son and daughter-in-law and grandson live in San Francisco. And last April, a little over a year ago, my daughter-in-law was getting ready to deliver my second grandchild. And so I went out to San Francisco to be ready, and Rose arrived about right on time. But I took her brother Samuel for a walk in the neighborhood one day, and we had a very fun walk. He's very cute. Every grandchild's cute, but he really is. And so we'd stop and talk to people, and we got a little tired and thirsty, and there's an Italian deli in the neighborhood, and I wheeled the carriage in, and he stops, and he points to the drink cooler, and he says, "That's what I get," and he points to an apple juice container, one of the more expensive ones, you know, the glass with the square in it. Found out that's not what he gets. The kid suckered me right off the bat. And then I said, why don't we share a cannoli? Because they make them fresh, and Grandpa really likes his cannolis. So I go and get the cannoli, and this deli put a cherry, a maraschino cherry, on each end of the cannoli. So he sits down, and I go to pick up the cannoli because they stuff it fresh. And I bring it over to the table, I put it down, and as I'm going to sit down, he picks it up and bites off one end. I said, is that good? He goes, mm-hmm. I said, good, now let me have a bite. And he turns it around and bites the other end and takes the other cherry. And I started laughing. Even though I was angry, I laughed. And he thought it was funny, so he kept eating. And I'm laughing, and the cannoli's disappearing. And finally, it gets to that little ring in the middle where there's no filling, and he says, here. Is it, that's how you share a cannoli? And it goes, yeah, why not? So that's my cannoli story with my grandson. And to this day, I have not shared anything with him ever again. Who else would like to speak? He was two, a little over two at the time.
Well, as I said before, my dad immigrated here in 1922. And in 1929, he got married. He took his new bride back to Germany for the honeymoon. And in 1937, they went back again because he was the only one from his family that came over here. And so I grew up with that, and they talked a lot of German in the house. My brother and I didn't learn any German, really. But when they didn't want us to know what they were talking about, then they would talk in German. And in 1952, he decided to take the family back to Germany, so there were four of us. And he had, a new car. And so we went over by boat. We went for 3 months, and he took the car with us. We went over on the Queen Mary. Came back in the Queen Elizabeth. So that was something in itself. And that they had two classes on the ships in those days, the first and second class. And if you were in second class, which we were, you could not go into the first class part of the ship. That was off limits. But anyway, we landed in Cherbourg, France. And Cherbourg had been decimated during the Second World War. And so we couldn't land, and we were out in the harbor, and he took us in by small boats into the harbor. And we got there, and the guy went through the paperwork, and he said to my dad, he said, Mr. Ziegler, I have to tell you this, you don't have the right paperwork to bring your car into the country. So they talked back and forth for a little bit, and he said, I'll tell you what, since you're going to be here for 3 months, you can go ahead and take the car, but you're going to have to contact your insurance company, and as soon as you get the right paperwork, you take it to Strasbourg, France, which is on the other side of France on the border of Germany, and then you'll be able to keep your car over here, and you can take it back with you when you leave. So we proceeded across France, not being able to speak the language, that was fun. We were in Paris and we went in for lunch and read the menu and said steak, you could read that, so we ordered, held up four fingers. And right after that they come with this great big platter of cold meats, and so we devoured that, and then they came with the main meal, that was just an appetizer, we didn't realize that at the time. I had to use a restroom in those days. You walked out of the building and across a little alley. You went through a door and it was tile floor with a hole in the middle of it. And then a place on each side of the hole for your feet corrugated into the tile. That was the bathroom facility. We got to the border. My dad turns around to me and he hands me something. And unbeknownst to me at the time, it was a .32 caliber revolver that he had bought when he was there in Germany on his honeymoon. And he brought this along for safety purposes, I guess. And he gave it to me, and I'm 12, and he says, here, you take this, put it inside your coat, they'll never check a 12-year-old. So every time we crossed the border during the 3 month period of time we were there, I got to carry this pistol across the border. And so when my parents passed on, I said to my brother, there's only one thing that I really want out of the house. I says, and that's that .32 caliber revolver that I carried back and forth across the border. Well, the big issue was that the town that my dad came from was very small, the Black Forest. They hadn't seen a car. No one in town had a car. So every day, almost the whole time we were there, my dad would park the car, and the kids from all over the village would come, and he'd take the kids for a ride in an automobile. That was the first ride they'd ever had in an automobile in 1952. And my brother and I mingled with the kids, and by the time we left, we could speak German. And because I was a son of a butcher, the kids, they were catching moles. And they would sell the mole skin to put in the finger lining of the gloves. So the mole skin is real soft, and that's what they did in those days. So they'd ask me to skin the moles for them, because my dad was a butcher, so I must know how to skin the animal. And then they would tack it up at the side of the barn and let it dry, and then whatever they did with it. But we visited Switzerland, we visited Austria, and traveled around Germany, and I've been back numerous times. I got to go back after I got drafted into the service. I was in the Army. I got into an Army band, and I got sent to Germany for 16 months, and I was there. Kennedy made his famous speech, Ich bin ein Berliner, and we played for him in Frankfurt. And I was planning to take my two granddaughters that just graduated high school in June to Germany. I took the grandson last year, and they couldn't make it this year, so hopefully I can take them back next year to see where their great-grandfather came from.
My name is Dina Stoll. Like Chuck, I also was thinking about how to remember my father who passed away in 2002. And I knew that other people had written long memoirs and various things, and somehow it just didn't fit right. I didn't think that anybody would read a long memoir. And I didn't trust that anybody would pull out the photo albums if I kept all the old photos. I just didn't have any kind of feeling of trust for anything, that any method that I already knew about. So I decided that I was going to write. I needed something short and sweet. That was my theory. That was the only thing that anybody would read. So I decided that I was going to write a children's book. So I wrote a children's book about my father. And it was also because I had many stories in my head about him. He was sort of an adventurous kind of guy. He was a clergy, so he had those stories. He was a rabbi. And I had lots of stories. And I thought about whether I wanted to do this in chronological order. You know, he was born here, and then he went here, and here, and here, and here. And I decided that I was just going to structure it around his stories. But there's some chronology in there as well. But. The book is on Amazon. It's available on Amazon. It's called Why the Rabbi Played Clarinet in the Sauna. He was a clarinet player. Not a professional player, but it was a hobby. And the process of writing the book took me 3 years. It was self-published through the Amazon process called Create Space. One of the interesting things for me, I have multiple drafts. Like I just finished speaking to a group of children about who are writing biographies, a group of first and second year olds about my process in writing this book. I'm not an author. This is my first book. I like to write, but this is not my profession. I was amazed in preparing my talk for the first and second year olds how many drafts I had. It's a children's book. There's not that much writing on each page. But how to take a story, how to take a life of a person and get down to the essence of it in the minimal amount of words in a way that's going to be interesting for a child. It took a lot of work. But it was a fun process. And I told the children that I was particularly grateful to my mother, who is alive, because she gave me the freedom to remember the stories the way I remember them. I checked in with her, so she read the stories, and my siblings read the stories. But she didn't say, and I acknowledge her in my comments, she didn't say, but this, or but that, or I remember it this way, or I remember it that way. She was just, this is your memory, this is great. And she, and my whole family was just incredibly supportive. So that was one interesting thing, is just how many drafts it takes. I think it takes more drafts to write a small amount of words than it does to write a long piece. The other interesting piece was working with an illustrator. Amazon.com has a choice. If you ever self-publish through them, they have a choice of like 10 or 12 different illustrators that you can choose. And I had a picture in my mind of what I wanted. I originally tried to get my kids to illustrate this book, which they could have done, but they didn't have time. So then I went to Amazon, and nothing worked. I wanted cartoon style, I wanted something light and friendly. I actually had thought about using photographs, old photographs, and putting them in the book, but I thought, if this is really a children's book, they don't necessarily gravitate towards old photos the way we might. So I thought that's not going to work. So I decided that I would put some of those photos in, but put them at the back of the book. But the book itself would be a children's book, you know, including the illustrations would have that feel. So I wanted this cartoon style, and I put an ad on Craigslist looking for an artist. I interviewed about 6 or 7 different people. And when you interview an artist, you don't meet them. I wanted to meet these people. people. Nobody wanted to meet me. It didn't matter, and they just needed to send me portfolios. They just needed to send me their drawings. So the entire, so I chose somebody. The entire process was over the computer, the entire thing. I never met her. Offered to meet her at the end, a banker. Not necessary. It takes time, and it's really not necessary. But it was a very interesting process because a writer is an artist, and a fine artist is an artist, and everybody has their opinions of how they want it to look. So even though I gave her a list, this is how I want this story to be illustrated, so I want this one, this is my idea, she came up with a drawing, and then I would say, but, and she would say, but I'm the artist. That was a very interesting process for me, and we had a couple of, it's all on email, so it's not like, you know, but 5 minutes, yeah. Just a couple of interesting back and forth about each couple of the drawings that we just didn't mesh on. So that also was a very, very interesting process for me. And in the end, I think I told you it took me 3 years from the idea to finally having it in my hand. It's 3 years.
Does it tell your father's story?
Yes, absolutely. And when I read it to children and adults, both enjoy the story just as much. I think that the adults just must feel that, wow, I captured this person's soul, you know, through the stories. And I think that's why they smile. And everybody in my family feels great about it. And I feel great about it because now I know that the great-grandchildren are going to know his story. So
thank you, Dina.